Stephen, I guess one of the key questions that's come up several times is just the big question, does the reality of suffering now, the fact that things aren't working now the way they should, does the reality of suffering, does that say to us that God is evil? Does it say to us that God is unloving? And if so, how should we deal with that?
It's a very, very big question. It's a very common question. It's a very good question. It's a perceptive question because you're looking around at the world and your own experience and you're saying, stuff sure doesn't seem to work really well for me and for a lot of other people and really badly for some people. And I'm told that God is both all-powerful and all-loving. And if he's all-powerful and he's all-loving and this stuff still keeps happening, how can he still be those things? Maybe he is all-powerful, but he's not loving enough to do anything about it. Or he is loving, but he's not powerful enough to do anything about that. Either way, he can't be the all-loving, all-powerful God of the Bible, and there still be all this evil and suffering in the world. I think it's a big question. It's a question that Christians have talked about for more than 2,000 years even, in some ways. Christians have written lots of responses to this. It's the field of what we call theodicy, making defenses for God on this particular issue. I don't think I'll solve your question because, as I said, there are volumes written around this sort of subject. I have three main things that I say when I normally talk about this thing. They're all taken from Timothy Keller's book, The Reason for God, and his particular chapter on evil and suffering in that book. The three things I say are this. Number one, I say evil and suffering is really, really, really bad, and the experience of it is terrible and traumatic. And trying to come to sense with that is terrible and traumatic in and of itself. And so we're wrestling with, what does that do to God? Does it make God disappear? Well, I know one thing. I know that if you take God out of the equation, it doesn't make it any better. In fact, it arguably makes it even worse. Because if there is no God, then there is absolutely no plan. There is no absolute possible way in which he is somehow justifying all of this and making it all fit together for the end of human history. Then there is just dog eat dog. The strong eat the weak. The rich eat the poor. And there is no rhyme or reason to that. So taking God out of the picture doesn't take our existential problems away. It in fact actually makes them worse. It makes our philosophical problems worse. If you're a higher grade philosopher at a university and you think, wow, I've checkmated God here on this suffering and evil thing, I'm like, okay, well, take God away. Oh, but your problem's still there. It's still there? Yes, it's still there. In fact, it's bigger now than it was before. But I know this is a Christian thing, and so you're particularly saying, well, do I know God exists? So the second thing I say is, and this is really a cold comfort answer, but I think it is a biblical answer, and I also think it is an extremely logical answer, and I mentioned it a little bit last week, and that is that God does, according to the Bible, operate on a plane of existence that is different to ours, and we operate on a need-to-know basis at some level. There are things God does in his person, in his character, in his wisdom, that we are not privy to. There are things he works out to work according to his good purposes. And all we are told is that God himself and his character is good and just and loving, and that he's going to resolve all this. And he said, okay, now you let me worry about the details, and you get on with living life. Now, I know that's called comfort. I know that doesn't make you go, oh, wow, now my heart is completely at ease with this. But I do think it's true. Just because it's not nice, warm words necessarily in that sense, it doesn't mean it's not true. And I think it is true. And I think it has to be true for an omnipresent God, omnipotent, omnibenevolent, that's the word, all good God to exist. Then that sort of stuff actually has to exist. God has to have a level up here that's like a closet that we don't get to go into, a realm of operating that we don't get to dig into. Otherwise, he's not God. Otherwise, he is just one of us. He's a peer. He's like us, and we're all just trying to solve these problems by ourselves. So that's called comfort, but I think the Bible explicitly says that in a number of places, and it's a very clear message throughout the Bible. And it was good enough for some people in the Bible. For people like Job, who underwent immense suffering, he is simply confronted with the character of God at the end of the book of Job. There is no neat little, this is why you suffered, Job, at the end of the book of Job. Job is simply confronted with the beauty and the glory and the majesty and the power of God. And he says, look, I misspoke. You're God. I don't get the stuff. You are God and you are good. And I worship you. So it is satisfying for some people if they are prepared to dig into that hard enough. But I know at the face level it can sound quite cold comfort. Then the third thing I always say is that When we see Jesus Christ dying on the cross to do something about all the evil and the suffering and the pain in this world, that doesn't tell us why pain and suffering exists in this world, but it does tell us why not. It does tell us that it's not because God doesn't care. Because here we have God himself entering into voluntarily. He doesn't have to do this. He can stand aloof and watch this world go into oblivion. He doesn't have to enter into this, but at an immeasurable personal cost to himself, he enters into our suffering through the person of Jesus Christ. And so the one thing that says to me is that God, in an infinite way, cares about me and cares about humanity and what happens to us. He cares about our suffering. He cares about our pain. And so you might sit there and you might come with all these complex situations. What about this person in this scenario and the immense pain and suffering there? What about this person in this scenario? And that's it. And I can't answer why that person had to suffer that way, or why that person got that disease, or why that young child died in that way. I can't answer all the specifics, but I can say I know what it isn't. If the Bible is true, it's not because God doesn't love us. It's not because God does not care way more than you care about that little individual, about that person, about all those other people suffering. And so when I hold those three things in tension, and then there's a whole lot of other stuff that I believe about God and his existence, I'm able to go, yes, Lord, this is very painful for me, and I don't understand it, and it vexes me, but you are God, and I will follow you. Makes sense.
Well, Stephen, you made comments at the start of your talk about relationship and intimacy, and that's how we created a simple question. Maybe. Given that, can Christians be introverted and like being alone? If
sure.
They're real Christians.
But of course, it's, this intimacy has nothing to do with personality type, whether you're an introvert or an extrovert. I minister to people in my congregation all the way along that spectrum. I have extreme extroverts like myself who just want to have people in their home all the time doing something, because otherwise I get a little bit twitchy if it gets too quiet. And I have people who just want to be away from people for large periods of time. All of us still need intimacy. All of us actually still need people. We just need people in different ways and in different times and at different capacity levels. But we all still take away intimacy, take away relationship altogether, we all crumble and we die, whether you're an extreme introvert or you're an extreme extrovert. And that any kind of psychologist will tell you as well, whether they're a believer or not.
Okay. Now, you spoke about the hope. That's what you took us towards.
Yep.
Why does this hope help if it's hope beyond this life? Yeah, in our lives, we're sure. Not going to see that. So how does it actually help?
It helps. Well, it helps in the sense of giving us perspective, first of all, and saying, well, is this all I've got? Because then basically, what's it? Eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. Just pour my life into creative, subjective meaning for myself and making myself as happy as I possibly can before that end comes for me, however it comes. So I think, first of all, by saying, well, there's a hope afterwards, says, okay, hang on, maybe this is not all of it. Maybe this is a preparation stage for something else, which then makes me really think about quite hard about what I'm doing in this time. So I actually think what you think about the end makes a big difference in what you do now. That's one of the reasons why I'm not really for kind of escapist, get out of hell, get into heaven Christianity, where Jesus is just there to basically give you fire insurance. You made a confession at one point in your life and said, Jesus, please save me, and I'm like, woo, I'm in heaven now and I can live how I want. I'm a much bigger end times kind of view guy, where I think the whole created world is going to be recreated. We're going to live in tangible bodies doing good things, and because justice and mercy will be the culmination of all of that and that world, I'm like, well, we get on with that work now in the present, because I'm going to be living in a land where there is no tear and where there is no suffering. I work now to alleviate tear and suffering. Because I'm going to live in a land where there's perfect justice, I work now to fight injustice. And so I think actually what you think is going to happen at the end, what you think God is going to do, radically influences what you're going to do in the present, how you're going to live in the present. And in many ways, it actually gives you confidence. A friend of mine, in fact, some folk came up to me just now and said they know this friend, and some of you might know him. His name is John Skippers. He works with me. He's our head deacon. He heads up all our mercy and justice ministry. He runs an organization called Isipambano Center for Biblical Justice, and we're looking at how to be more just Christians. And you know what? Once you go down that road and you start investigating what it means to be a just person in an unequal society like South Africa, you will be overwhelmed with the need. You will be crushed and you will be broken down, and you'll go, I can't do anything about this. absolutely cannot make a dent in the reality that is South Africa for so many people. But if I know God is going to fix everything in the end, then I can actually, this whole thing doesn't fall on me. It's not on my shoulders anymore. I can get up and I can work and I can serve just ends in this life, and it's not all on my shoulders. And I can do it with joy and gladness because I know somehow God is going to bring that justice into complete fruition one day in the new heavens and the new earth. So I think it radically changes you and gives you much more tangible hope in the present if you have a secure hope in the future beyond this life.
Okay. We did say we'd open the floor, so there is a microphone. If you've got a question from the floor that you particularly want asked over there, please speak into the microphone.
No, I just want to ask whether you think one of the possible reasons for the pain and suffering in the world isn't because man chose to disobey and ignore God.
Sure. I certainly think that, and it's a good question. C.S. Lewis says the same thing. He says pain and suffering is God's megaphone to a dying world. I think that's part of it, but I always want to emphasize that it's only part of it. It's part of the warning signs going on and saying, guys, things are not right. Stuff is broken in this world. I live in Sea Point. I don't know if you've been to Sea Point recently, but there's a lot of happy, shiny people there. My wife and I are kind of like, we live in the wrong neighborhood. We're just not as happy and shiny as these people on the promenade going all day long with amazing bodies, all look like models. They're filming things outside our house all the time. And I'm going like, I really don't think we fit here so much. And there's this happy shininess going on there all the time. And I think God has to kind of come to us and say, look, guys, this is a false reality. This world is in turmoil. It's broken. And pain and suffering has a way of doing that in our lives and reminding us of that fact. So I think that's at least part of what it is.
Stephen, somebody writes, as a non-Christian in your audience, what's your message to me tonight?
Sure. That's a great question. I'm very glad that you're here to listen to us engage and that you're willing to engage. I think what I would want to say to you is I would want to say, what's stopping you from exploring this vision of the end? You might have certain objections in you that say, okay, well, I'm not sure about this and I'm not sure about that. But I've got to be honest with you. I think what I just said is pretty amazing. Not that I'm amazing at saying it, but the stuff I spoke about the end, is pretty flippin' amazing. From an objective point of view. If it's true, it's unbelievable. That's worth looking into, I think, then. Giving time and energy and saying, well, why do so many people around the world, through so many ages, believe in this thing? I think that's worth looking into. I don't think that's a silver bullet argument. It's probably a terrible philosophical argument, but I think it makes sense to me. And that is like, this world sucks in many ways. It really does. It really sucks in so many different ways. The amount of trauma I have to deal with people all the time as a pastor and sit next to people as stuff is happening. There are days when I'm like, I give up. I completely give up. And so if there's just some possibility that this is true, wow, we would be foolish to not look into it and study it and just see for ourselves what about it is so compelling. So I think that would be my message to you.
If this hope is real, why is God so slow about it? It creeps me out that he's chilled letting us suffer.
Yeah. It would creep me out too if I felt he was chilled in letting us suffer as well. I think one of the things the Bible seems to say to me is that God is very patient with us as humanity. And so part of the reason why it extends is that he's desperately reaching out to us in many different ways and forms through his church in the interim. And he wants to see more and more people come to a realization of this truth. I think that is one of the reasons. I do also come back to my same reason. I think God operates on a different time scale to you and me. I remember when, and I get something like this. I remember when I was in high school. School felt like it took ages, right, to get to matric. And to get out to university, like, this is amazing. I've spent my whole life doing this. It's taken such a long, 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 long time. And now my 20th school reunion is about to come up on me. And I'm like, I could pass for a school kid, right? Hey, come on. And so I'm seeing the disparity in how I understood time there, just for myself as a human being, as a fallible human being. And so I suspect God works on a different time scale to the rest of us, being an uncreated being from eternity past to eternity future. And so, yes, those come back to the similar questions. Why the pain and suffering? Why the time scale? All that sort of stuff. There's a point where I've got to say, I'm going to look at who God is in his character. And I'm going to say, do I think he is that person? If he's that person, I can trust in him to make those decisions on my behalf when I don't have the pay grade to make those decisions. If he's not that person, then why bother trusting him at all?
In the new heaven, will I be reunited with loved ones who've gone before me? What will our relationship be like? Is there evidence, biblical evidence for that?
I want to be careful how I answer this question. I don't know all the answers to those sorts of questions, those complex questions at some level. I believe that we will live a tangible bodily experience in the new heavens and the new earth. My own view is that it's this present earth that will be recreated. There's a difference of opinion amongst different Bible scholars, but my own view is that this present world will be made new. So Sea Point will basically be extended to everywhere then at that point. Now, in that relationship, we will have tangible human existence with each other, where we will connect with each other, we will befriend each other, we will have intimacy and relationship. My reading from Scripture is that that level of intimacy and connection will be so complete, so universal, that I wonder if stuff like old familial ties and that might be a little bit irrelevant in that end equation. And we've kind of almost progressed past that, which is hard for me to figure out because, I mean, I've got two children that I would give my life for and that I feel deeply, deeply emotionally attached to right now. And the thought of, like, not having that relationship is a little bit weird and scary. But at another level, I see God as saying, those desires for intimacy, those desires for relationship that you have right now that are experienced in certain different relationships you have with friends and family and that will all be completely met in this new community of redeemed people. So if your friends and family have believed in the gospel, then I believe they'll be part of that redeemed community.
So is it fair to say that part of the fulfillment of intimacy and removal of tears and sorrow is an immense satisfaction in God?
Yes. Yeah. So I basically think you're getting everything met in God, that you no longer have these needs and these desires. Although the funny thing is he still wants to keep us in community. I don't think he's going to now, everyone's going to be standing in their own cubicle fixated on God, and you don't look at the guy next to you. I think we're going to live in nice community with each other and enjoy each other now in light of God, but with our hearts being satisfied completely in God.
There are a couple of questions on becoming a Christian and what that means. And just so you know, I'm deliberately not answering those tonight because I'm really hoping you'll join us next week for the finale where our speaker next week, Richard, is going to touch on that specifically. So I'm not ignoring your questions. I'm forcing you to come back, which is wicked and evil, I know, but God loves you.